Welcome to Tori Mecha Parsha with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Siti Zuckerman, and today we'll be learning Parsha Shlach. My high school students sometimes have a hard time understanding how people in Tanakh could have made mistakes. When I mentioned the sin of Adam, eating from the tree of knowledge, some of my students couldn't wrap their heads around it. What was so hard about waiting a few hours? But obviously, since this is one of the most foundational mistakes in all of human experience, the story must not be as simple as it seems. Adam wasn't more weak-willed than your average woman on a diet, God forbid. So clearly, there's something deeper at play here. Another central and fundamental sin in Tanakh is the sin of the spies. The root cause of any foundational sin is going to teach us something universal and fundamental about the human condition and the human personality. Like many stories in Chumash, a superficial reading of the story of the spies leaves us wondering why it was so difficult not to slander the land. And that question becomes even stronger when we remember who the spies were. These were truly great people, leaders of this elevated generation. Rashi says that the Torah calls them Anashim, which signifies important people. And at first they were Kesherim, not just good, but great people. So let's try to understand more deeply what was going on here. Rav Valba in Ali Shor explains that Hashem created us with natural drives, and we shouldn't denigrate them. They're there to help us build the world. Kina, jealousy, pushes us to learn and grow through kina sofrim, jealousy of a Torah scholar, which increases wisdom. Do we use that drive to propel us to learn more Torah and to connect to Hashem, or to compete over who has a more prestigious degree or a bigger house? Taiva, desire, pushes us to get married and build a family. Do we use that drive to bond deeply and give to our spouse in marriage? Kavod, desire for honor, pushes us to build the world. Do we use that drive to protect Hashem's honor? The key is how we utilize these drives and for what purpose we direct them. If you think about it, the main distinction in how we use our drives is based on whether our motivation is self-focused or truly other-focused. This is very subtle and requires deep self-awareness. For people on the level of the spies, it demanded honesty that reaches into the deepest levels of the subconscious. To understand why such a subtle distinction matters, imagine a computer program developed for a sensitive national defense purpose. If it's off by even one letter, the whole system crashes. There was a huge amount at stake in the spies' mission to scout out the land. Their goal was one of earth-shattering proportions, the actualization of the vision of Sinai in the land of Israel, which is essentially the purpose of the world. And whether their actions stemmed from a truly altruistic or a slightly self-serving place was very important. When the spies slandered the land of Israel, they not only caused their generation to die in the desert, but their sin is the cause of all exile throughout history. The challenge was tremendous, and the mistake was subtle. But what propelled them to slander the land? And what is its connection to exile? Our approach here is based on Moshe Shapiro and the Sefer Mima Makim. Ramchal in his Yosef Sharim says that the spies sinned because they knew that they were going to lose their leadership status once they entered the land. Their fear of losing their status caused them to try to prevent the people from entering. But they were such great people. Were they really focused on their own honor in such a blatant and crass way, especially when they knew the consequences would be so enormous? The Sfas Emes takes a different approach than the Ramchal, saying that their motivation was spiritual. They wanted to remain at the higher, more supernatural level of life in the desert rather than entering the more natural framework of life in Eretz Yisrael. Perhaps we can combine the two approaches. On the conscious level, their motivation seemed entirely spiritual and altruistic. But on a deeper, more subconscious level, there was a small sliver of fear about losing their status, a subtle trace of ego, which misdirected them and led them astray. Perhaps the fact that their conscious motivation, despite being well-intended, contradicted Hashem's will, should have alerted them to a deeper motivation at play. Think about it this way. Have you ever interacted with someone who insists they're acting for one reason while it's obvious that there's another unspoken motivation underneath? There are obvious examples, like the person who says they're just evening out the sides of the cake, or the child who asks for more candy in honor of Shabbos. And there are countless subtle examples where we're not even aware of our own subconscious motivations. So we have a better picture of the motivation that made this a big challenge for the spies, but we're still left with a question. What exactly did they do wrong? Weren't they simply reporting on what they saw in the land? There are many approaches to this. Let's look at the Gemara in Sanhedrin 104b, commenting on the verses in Megillas Eicha. In the first chapters of Eicha, the verses are arranged alphabetically. The first verse begins with an aleph, the second with a bays, and so on. However, the verse beginning with the letter pei appears before the verse beginning with ayin, reversing their normal order. And the Gemara explains that this reversal is due to the behavior of the spies, who said with their peh, their mouths, what they didn't see with their ayin, their eyes. And Rashi explains that they said things before they actually saw them with their eyes. But what does that mean? Didn't they speak after they had already seen the land? How do you speak before you see? To understand this, let's think about how sight works. The eye is like a mini brain. It gathers countless pieces of information and integrates them into a single picture. Vision only works when information can be absorbed into a coherent framework. When something is blurry, the eye struggles to function because it can't organize the information into a meaningful whole. The eye doesn't really see without comprehension. It needs a way to connect details into a unified picture. If we saw the world the way a piece of abstract modern art looks, we'd become dizzy and disoriented. Our minds work similarly. We need a framework, a context through which we organize the information we encounter. Spiritual sight works the same way. We need a lens through which we filter reality to fit all the details into a coherent understanding. Only then can we assign meaning and interpretation to what we see. If we have strong spiritual vision with a seichel that's aligned with Torah, then we can be attuned to the deeper reality of the world. A Torah true mind looks at everything through this lens. It sees wealth as a tool for giving, people as souls housed in bodies, and challenges as opportunities for growth. A mind that's attuned to purpose knows that we're in this world to move outside of ourselves and fulfill Hashem's will without personal bias. The peh, the mouth, on the other hand, is responsible for bringing that vision to external expression and actualization in the world through speech and then action. The spies put peh before ayin. They saw the land physically, but they failed to see it on a deeper, more internal level. They were drawn after appearance and externality, and they didn't contemplate what's true on a deeper level. So for example, they saw fortified cities and they drew a superficial conclusion. In the external peh approach, walls mean military strength. Had they viewed things through their spiritual sight, they would have realized that true strength comes from spiritual merit. If these nations needed walls, they must be lacking in merit, and therefore the walls are a sign of weakness. Since they didn't see things through a spiritual lens, they cried. The word for crying in Hebrew is bechi, related to the word mivucha, confusion. Crying blurs the eyes. Without a framework to understand what they saw, they became confused, fearful, and despairing. Since they placed mouth before eye, they were punished with their tongues extending to their navels. This entire incident with the spies is called a nisayon, a test. The Maharal explains that the word nisayon comes from the word nes and minusa, a test. A test reveals whether a person can rise above his nature and transcend a natural, more superficial perspective. For the spies, that would have meant recognizing that they were viewing reality through a lens of fear and externality. It would have meant acknowledging that perhaps this perspective was being shaped by a subtle fear of losing their role, their significance, their value. So we understand the motivation and the nature of the challenge, but why is this the cause of all exile? The answer is rooted in the connection between the sin of the golden calf and the sin of the spies. The Mishnah in Tainus 26a links the two by listing the tragedies that happened on Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, which is the day of the sin of that the sin of the spies took place, and on the 17th of Tammuz, which is the date of the sin of the golden calf. These are the two sins recognized with fast days because together they're the cause of national destruction and exile. The reason these two sins are the root of exile is because they're both connected to the bris, the covenant between Hashem and the Jewish people that was established with the giving of the Torah at Sinai. This bris is compared to the bris nisuin, the marriage of a husband and wife. At the root of these sins, there was a subtle, unspoken aspect of self-interest. And self-interest is essentially a pivot away from relationship. But in what way do these two sins signify a running away from relationship? The understanding is as follows. Since Sinai is compared to a wedding of Hashem and the Jewish people, then the Gemara in Shabbos 88b explains the sin of the golden calf is compared to a bride who is unfaithful under her chuppah. The Ramban explains that it's as if the covenant was nullified. This rupture in relationship with Hashem began with the worship of the golden calf and was solidified through the sin of the spies. With these sins, the people were essentially asking for a less intense, less supernatural relationship with Hashem. They wanted a relationship that they could choose and shape for themselves, one in which they would find Hashem behind the veil of nature. At first glance, this sounds noble. It sounds like a relationship they would earn and build through their own efforts. But when the spies went to scout the land, they failed to find Hashem behind nature. They fell into the trap of seeing reality through the external perspective of Peh, rather than the deeper perspective of Ayin. It's a trap where people see military strength, economic success, or personal accomplishment as disconnected from Hashem's involvement. They fell into the trap that they themselves had created. And the fact that they requested this challenge and then failed it suggests that perhaps their desire for a more distant relationship was not entirely altruistic. Perhaps, instead of seeking this new form of relationship in order to serve Hashem better, that desire was tainted by self-interest, by a subtle and subconscious need for personal honor and external validation. This request for distance, born on some level from self-interest, constituted a breach in the relationship itself. And once they chose distance from Hashem, that distance naturally expressed itself as galus, a reality in which Hashem's presence is hidden. This also explains why the spies specifically degraded Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is defined as a bias, the home in which the covenant of Sinai is meant to be actualized and lived. The spies received the natural context they had asked for, and it ultimately expressed itself in destruction and exile on the very dates of those original sins. The Gemara in Sanhedrin 104b explains that after hearing the spies' report, the people cried a b'chiya shel chinam, an unwarranted cry. And as a result, Hashem will establish a b'chiya ledoros, a crying for generations. At first glance, this may sound punitive, but in truth, it's exactly the opposite. It's a loving and reparative response. The tears of exile are meant to heal the breach itself. Through crying, yearning, and longing for renewed closeness, we rebuild the connection that was damaged. Think about a human relationship. When we deeply hurt someone we love, we experience distance and loss. That pain drives us to cry and to say, I care. I never wanted to hurt you. I never wanted to turn away from you. That is why the Gemara in Bava Basra 60b says that whoever mourns for Yerushalayim will merit to see its joy. It's not about going through the motions of mourning. It's about genuine mourning, real feelings of loss, yearning, and longing, which become the vehicle for true repair. We can ask ourselves, do we yearn for a relationship with Hashem? And can that propel us to look at ourselves deeply and examine our motivations to understand why we do the things we do? Absorbing the Torah's vision, its worldview on life, together with real personal honesty, can help us align ourselves with a true spiritual vision of the world. May we all aspire to that 2020 vision. Thank you for learning together.